This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is January 28th, 1997. We're at Tandem Press, and I'm here with Drew Stevens, Paula Panchenko, Warrington Colescott, and Art Hovey, and we're going to be talking about Tandem today, right?
Right.
Warrington, why don't you start?
Okay. Paula, could you simply sketch in a little the early days of Tandem Press as you experienced it, when you joined the staff? How did this come about, and what was the year that you actually came aboard?
Okay. Well, I joined the staff in November 1989, and Tandem had been in existence for 2 years at that stage. And the organization was very small. There was one master printer, Andy Rubin, and a number of graduate students who were assisting him. And there wasn't any other staff at that time. I was asked to hire a curator. So I was brought in as administrative co-director. In fact, just before I started, the organization had gone through a restructuring. There had been a curator, and then there had been a master printer who had been there for 1 year. The organization was founded by Bill Wiege, and then he hired a master printer about a year later, and then a year after that there was a major restructuring. And so I came in as administrative co-director with Bill Wiege. Then he resigned from that position a couple of years later, but has always remained spiritually, I think probably is the best word to describe it, involved with the organization, always helping with, you know, problem solving. He has remained, of course, on our board of advisors, but he, a couple of years after that, I can get you the exact date, pulled back from the day-to-day workings of the organization. And then about 2 years ago, we hired a full-time second printer, and that his name is Bruce Crownover. Over the last 8 years that I've been here, well, 7.5 years, we've had three curators, and we're about to have a fourth. There was the initial curator at the beginning, whose name was Trudy Hansen, who really was responsible for really setting up the entire structure of Tandem Press in an administrative and curatorial way. Then we had a second curator, Susanna Patrick, who was with the organization for a year, and then Martha Chizeth, who had been a graduate student and worked here for 3 years, and then Samantha Becker, who has worked here for 2 years.
In terms of the activity, when you came in, was there a change in activity as against the earlier, the sort of pace of the artists that were coming in?
Well, I think that the organization, the vision of the organization, the parameters of that vision were set by Bill Wiege, in terms of the number of artists whom we should be bringing in every year. And that was always about 8 to 10. I think that what Tandem was set up at the height of the art market, just as it was about to crash. I've done an analysis on this, and if you look at the prices of prints, if you look at prices of prints around 1983, 84, 85, you see the successive increase. I mean, for the same print. And then 1989, 90, it reached incredible heights. If you just take one print like a Jasper Johns or any of the very major name artists, then 90, end of 90, 91, there's a dramatic crash where it goes back to what prices were before or at the same time as they were released several years earlier. I think what happened was that when Tandem was set up, it was set up when everything was selling, and people felt that that part of Tandem would look after itself, really. We would make the prints. I mean, Bill's vision was that there should be a press at the university so that the visiting artist program could be reinstituted. He felt there was a very strong visiting artists program here in the 70s, and that he himself had learned a huge amount by these very distinguished artists who had come to the campus. He felt that the one way to do this, because of the success of cutbacks in funding, which had occurred over the years, would be to set up a press, bring back nationally recognized artists. Then the artists would make prints, we would split the editions, we would sell the prints, and that would support the entire operation. And certainly, in 1987, when he had this vision, I mean, he got 20 people to buy subscriptions, many of them in Madison, which was an extraordinary thing. I mean, he got people to pay $10,000 a piece, and suddenly he had $200,000. Well, you know, who would not have believed that this was not going to be something that would work financially? I think that in the two successive years, people began to experience that, you know, this crash. And I think the energies that had gone into Tandem had gone into what sort of artists we should have and excellent curatorial standards. And I think that as what I found then when I came in was that there was not a great emphasis on clientele and actually marketing the prints and selling the prints and using Tandem as an entity, and I think using it to really, I mean, it wasn't being sold as an idea to a much broader range of people. I think people felt it would just sort of take off without the marketing push. And I think that's probably one of the big developments that probably took place. So I think that we probably have the same number of artists who come here. We have tried to get a broader range of artists, but that was certainly within the initial vision. But one of the things that we have had to do is step up our activities in relation to what we do here. So I would say the artistic end has remained very consistent, the quality getting better every year. But I think that the activities that we organize around that have completely developed. I mean, we could do a lot more, but I think that they have developed a lot.
Now, the sort of role model, as I understand it, for Tandem was the University of South Florida at Tampa,
mm-hmm.
and Echo Press.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that too?
I do, but I think that well, there's sort of a number of ways. I think we were probably closer to Echo Press in terms of our facilities.
I think Trudy had come from Echo
right,
Press.
Right. Well, she had set up the archive for Echo Press. I don't know. I think she had worked within the museum structure. She hadn't actually worked for the press, but she had been responsible for establishing the archive at the museum at Indiana University. That's true, because Sam Gilliam had known of her from his work there and had recommended her here. And so she came with, you know, extraordinary museum standards in curatorial work. In talking with both Echo Press and the University of South Florida, I think that we were much closer to Echo Press. Mm. We had the same sort of, I mean, the facilities were not enormous. The administrative structure that was different was that they were established under the foundation, and they were not affiliated to the Department of Art at all. In terms of the University of South Florida, they were an independent entity within the university, because the man who set up the university graphic studio was a dean, and he sort of knew how administratively things work in a university. You know, where is the power? The power is with the dean. I mean, he actually said that to me. He said to me, you know, he asked me how we were structured, and he said to me, you know, you should change this. This was like this was my very first. You know, I went down there, and you know, he closed the studio. He didn't allow me to see how things were being printed. This was Donald Saff. He was extremely nice to me, but he thought they were doing some secret technique. And I described it to Bill Wiege when I came back, and he said, "Oh yeah, I know how that's done." And he described the whole thing and how it was done. And then he said to me, you know, it would be, you know, the way you should do this is set this up with the dean and keep it, you know, a complete entity unto itself. I think the graphic studio, I mean, Echo Press, they were set up exactly the same way that we were financially, whereas Graphic Studio was not. Graphic Studio received, and I think, about 70% of its funds from the university in terms of direct funding. They not only got university funding, but they got funding directly from the state. And that was, all due credit for that was, you know, from Donald Saff. He knew how administrative structures worked within the university, and he, you know, made sure that that happened. He then also got them their own building and so on and so forth, but he made sure that there was funding. And he also was very, he had the whole idea of Graphic Studio was that it was a research institute, and that was how he got money within the university. It was research funding for a research institute, and he stressed that in everything that he did. Now, when Echo Press was set up, they were set up under the foundation. They were set up, and you know, the art market was doing well, and things were beginning to develop. And they would go to print fairs or to art fairs, and they would sell a lot of prints, and they had a lot of clientele. They definitely, I think, they liked the relationship of being under the foundation. So that structure was different from us. I mean, talking with all the other print studios, I really felt that Tandem should be under the art department. I mean, all the arguments that people would give me, they were very abstract. And I could see, perhaps administratively, yeah, maybe. But in actual fact, I found being a part of the art department was just the right place. You know, I think that, you know, that's our job. You know, we are affiliated to the Department of Art, and I enjoy it. So I didn't see it as a problem at all.
Specifically, though, how does your affiliation with the department and with the School of Education, how does that work? What is your structure?
Okay, well, I mean, it's interesting from the arts administration point of view, I guess. Administratively, it is 100% under the Department of Art. 100%. Insofar as all our requisitions are signed by the chairman of the art department. All requests for payment are signed by the chairman of the art department. All hiring is done through the art department. All our students are hired through the art department. We are a separate fund. So if we hire a student here, the timesheets have to be signed in the art department, but the funding has to come from here. So it's a line item of funding. Now, if I want to do something unusual, which we often have to do at Tandem because we're sort of an unusual entity, I mean, we have to go to the dean. So we've always, I would administratively talk with Jim Escalante, inform him of what I'm going to do, and talk then to the dean's office. The dean's office recognizes that Tandem is a very unusual entity. And so I think that to overcome that and to help us out, they appointed Hank Loeffler, who is associate dean in the School of Ed, as a liaison to Tandem Press. So I would also report to him, and I do. So I report simultaneously to two people, to Jim Escalante, or the existing chair, and to Hank. The School of Education, I think, continues to recognize that it's important that the dean's office be aware of Tandem and what we're doing. And when Hank Loeffler was promoted to the Chancellor's office as a special assistant to the Chancellor, he retained a 10% position in the School of Ed, and one of his responsibilities remained Tandem. So they themselves recognize this. Now, in the broader scheme of things, we have a board of advisors, of people who are drawn from the community and outside the community. We have, and we report to them every 3 months. We have an artistic advisory committee, which consists mostly of faculty and a couple of community members who advise on the artists who we might have here at Tandem. But the Board of Advisors does not have real, I mean, it does not really have power to say, say you can or you can't do this. That authority definitely lies with the art department and with the School of Education. The complexities probably for the art department is that they may not be familiar with some of the things that we need to do or how to do them. And so often we have to go directly to the School of Education to get that sort of advice because of the complexity of some of the things that we're doing. You know, if we want to, you know, order frames or something that are over $15,000 and there's a limit that's prohibited by the state. I mean, the art department wouldn't generally know certain kinds of information that we would only get at the dean's office. And so the dean's office recognizes this, and I think they've sort of put that structure in place.
You meet with the executive committee of the art department?
I go to all faculty meetings, and I'm on the long-range planning committee of the art department. I'm not on the executive committee because I'm not a voting member of the department. And only voting members serve on the executive committee.
So then you don't have professorial rank at this point?
No.
Do you feel it would be better if you did have, or does it give you a certain freedom not being in that structure, the rank structure of the university?
Well, I wouldn't be qualified. So for me, me individually, I would not be qualified to be a professor. I mean, I don't have the qualifications or the skills. So it would be a moot question for me. Do I think that someone who would come to this position might
would it be an advantage?
Would it be an advantage? Well, I have never found it to be a disadvantage. I mean, when I went to the art department meeting yesterday, for example, people were talking about arts administration, marketing programs for students. And I talked to, so it was deferred anyway to the curriculum committee, and I went to see the person who's in charge of that, the chair of that committee, and I said, you know, you can always include Tandem in anything that you're doing on marketing the arts, because I feel that we're part of the art department, and we will be happy to share all this information with the students. We'll be happy to tell people how discounts work and where people can sell prints and who are the top galleries and what galleries succeed in. And I mean, we have all that information at our fingertips. Sometimes maybe because we're not located closer to the university, that may be a problem. People sort of may forget about us. So if anything, I think it's distance is probably the thing that may be the biggest difficulty. But I really go to all the meetings, and we include the faculty in lots of our programs here. And I think that, you know, one of the things we've tried to do here is also expand the role of the faculty. We now have a program in the graduate school where a faculty member can come here every year and make a print and get funded salary support to do that, and additional funds to do that. And then we try to reach out and do a number of projects with faculty. We include the faculty, of course, in the Artistic Advisory Committee and on the board.
I should think that the university would be very favorable for a lot of reasons, but one reason that seems to me important is that Tandem has reached out to the community. You know, at one time there really was a kind of antagonism between town and gown here, the business community and the university. And I think, to me, it seems that Tandem has been a major bridge drawing these units together. Do you think that's accurate?
I do. I think that we've done lots of things. I mean, the prints are in all the all the major collections in town, and I think that that's been very good. several of the major corporations, the Pleasant Company, Marshall Erdman and Associates, Rayovac, the Madison Kipp Corporation, are all subscribers. I think we've also reached out to corporations statewide. Quad Graphics, for example, has purchased 5 subscriptions from Tandem. And then I also think that we've reached out to a lot of, lately it seems that we've been able to reach out to alumni, not only on a local level, but on a national level. I mean, we now meet people when we go to the print fair, which is essentially a totally marketing experience for Tandem. We meet a lot of alumni who are very proud to come. And many of these people are major donors to the university, and they might never give any money to Tandem, which is fine. But I think they feel very good about, meeting people from the university in this art context. So in that regard, I think that we've done a lot of that. The School of Education, I think, really recognizes that too, though, because they have actually used us to showcase the School of Education, and they have helped us fund some things. A few years ago, we did a show in California and one in Chicago, and they funded a reception at that show. And then they invited all their distinguished alumni. And, you know, in those instances, you know, you don't have results immediately, but you have results after some time. And so I think that that's been very beneficial. And I think we could do a lot more of that. Sometimes it's a little hard to maybe coordinate things, but some of the things that we do maybe are a little too commercial, and you want them not to be. Our settings might be a little too commercial, and you want things not to be so commercial.
Well, of course, commercial is a part of art.
Yes, and, definitely.
Know, the big picture there. And it would seem to me that your research function, part of it would be the marketing research that you do. Do you have any way to tie that into, say, the graduate program? Do you have graduate students that are interning in the office, in the gallery?
Well, now, we have students who have interned. Well, they haven't really interned. I mean, but I guess you could call it an internship. They work here, and they pretty much do everything. I mean, we really give them full responsibility. We pay them either student hourly, or some of them are eligible to apply for work study, and we give them a huge amount of responsibility. We've had people from the Arts Administration program, and we've had students from the Art Department, and we've had students from the Art History Department. And of course, then in the studio, we have a lot of students who also work with the master printers. Seems to me in the next few years we're kind of going to see some dramatic results. We have noticed that many of the graduate students who've worked here have gone on to get full-time teaching positions, even though they haven't actually taught. But the fact they've worked at Tandem has been a great boost to their chances of getting a job. And I don't know whether we get such committed students as well. You know, if you're a student at the university, even getting over to Tandem every day, you know, that shows a certain amount of commitment. And but we see that seems to have been very, very successful.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a very good item to have on their resume.
Yeah, very good.
Because I think more and more teaching in the graphic arts and in printmaking, it often includes some printing and publishing. As you know, I think a lot of universities are going this way, to a smaller degree.
Right.
But where printing experience on a professional level is handy.
Well, one fun thing that happened this year was that Lisa Beth Robinson, who's been a graduate student here for a number of years, I always want to send out a holiday card in December, and this is always the task that everybody goes like, oh. No, do we have to do it this year, you know? And I'm saying, oh, yes, we're a press, we have to do it. We have to send it to, you know, all our subscribers and all our board members. How many, you know? Well, I think we probably have about 500 that have to go out. Hand-printed, yes, hand-printed. I'm going to cheer everybody up. Anyway, we go, and I always try to get someone who would volunteer to do this, too, you know, in their own time. So one of our students this year did this, Lisa Beth Robinson, who is a wonderful student. And So I sent it out to everybody, and the curator at the Whitney Museum of Art, David Keel, called me when he got the card, immediately when he got it, opened it up and called me and wanted to know who printed it, because he was going to open a file with her name on it and put it in the archives of the Whitney. So of course I called her, and then I have to tell you, I did taunt everybody else, but telling them that this too could happen to you. So anyway, but that was very exciting for her, and she said that it would keep her going all year long.
You'll have more volunteers next
year. Yes, yes, and I had no idea it was going to happen, so I felt truly good about it. But it was, she was ecstatic, and everybody was surprised, I think. And I think that, you know, it was a, you know, these small things, you know, make a big difference. And it's important that we, you know, do that.
But the major thrust of the research purpose of the press is in the back, doing
yes.
the printing, working with the artists.
Yes.
And now that seems to have been very successful, right?
Very.
Yeah.
Very.
From your point of view and from the students' point of view.
I think it's, yeah. I mean, I think it's been very successful on every level. I mean, there isn't one level that it is not successful on. For us, probably, the only thing that is difficult for us, I think, is that we have the commitment and we have the talent to enable artists to do what people can do anywhere else in the country. But the one thing that we're a little lacking on are facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you go to a place like Graphic Studio, you know, it was top-of-the-line facilities. And I think that some of the things that we would like to do, if we could, you know, expand our facilities, that would be, we would really, it would really be terrific. But other than that, I mean, I think that we've achieved an enormous amount. And I think that really Bill Wiggy inspired everybody to think that everything was possible. And so that motto really runs through, even though he, you know, is not really involved. Well, this year he is, because he's teaching all his classes here, because since the art department has closed down, so he's back giving us lots of instructions about, you know, what we should be ordering, and it's ridiculous that we're not doing this, so that's good. It's inspiring us all again. And but I think he was very inspirational about, you know, never saying no, trying to work out if something was possible, and letting an artist do things. And I think that we've had, and I think with someone like Andy Rubin's temperament, which is, you know, very steady, I mean, he is, as a person, he is the absolute opposite of me, which is sort of an amazing kind of thing. I mean, I get worried about things, and I get sort of into a state. And when things go wrong, sometimes I can't even look. And I see the artist's worried faces, and I'm worried. And Andy just says, well, we'll just start all over and do it again. You know, and it's a wonderful attribute. I mean, he's so even, and he just will start it all over again. You're not happy, we'll start it all over again. I mean, and I think that the artists really respect him for that. And I think our second printer, Bruce Crownover, with his woodworking skills and woodblock skills, where he loves to carve blocks, and his etching capabilities have really complemented Andy, and that's been terrific too. And I think all the artists, without exception, have been, you know, very happy. Lots of them want to come back. So,
yeah. Well, Andy is really your most experienced professional,
mm-hmm.
in that he had, I don't know how long he worked at Gemini, but he started there.
Right. Well, he was there, I think, for a couple of years, but then he had worked with Leonard Lehrer.
Yeah.
And then he had studied printmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, he really never was in a situation where he wasn't printmaking. I mean, so...
And printing in collaboration with other artists.
Exactly.
So he was very experienced.
Very experienced.
So,
and he's able to, you know, work with people who have a great deal of experience and just move in on that level. But he's also very good at working with people who have no experience and putting them at their ease. And I think that that's probably been one of, you know, a very successful thing that he's done. And, I mean, Andy is the sort who will, you know, come in at 8 o'clock in the morning and if it isn't done, he'll still be here maybe at midnight. So, and I've seen him work like that a lot. And also, he never says, you know, darn it, Paula, I'm not doing this again. But no, he's totally committed. I mean, he's totally committed to what he does. I mean, he's a true professional. There's no question.
That's the way the business is.
Yeah.
I mean, when the artists come, you really have to give it everything.
Right. Walk their dogs.
Yeah.
Do everything. Do
Take
everything.
Take your break after they leave.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's our philosophy. I mean, we really do. I think we're there all the time. I mean, and you all...
When you first came?
Andy said to me, well, it's always easier to work with artists, you know, when you know them a little bit better. And I didn't really understand that, but, you know, I think the collaborations have become more successful when we've had artists back again and again, because people don't have to go through the both people working and learning how to work with each other. While that has always been very successful, it just becomes even easier when people come back a second and third time. And so we have brought people back, although we'd like to have lots of new artists coming in. For a range of work, we also it's also wonderful to have artists coming back.
Do you have a policy covering that? I mean, do you have anything sort of written down or planned in terms of how many people you invite back, or is it just it's as you need them or as you feel you'd like to have them back?
Well, I think when we meet, we only probably meet once or twice a year, and we review the people whom we've had, and then we review the people whom we would like to get. And generally at that point, we discuss who we would like to bring back.
Who are we?
Okay, that's the Artistic Advisory Committee. And right now, the people who serve on that, there have been a range of people who've served on that. The people who serve on that now are... Laurie Beth Clark, Susie Benger, Bill Wiege, myself, and Ellen Johnson. And then the staff also do sit in on that meeting. So Andy Rubin and Bruce Cranover would sit in, and the curator. But the suggestions primarily come and are voted on by the Artistic Advisory Committee members. And so... to a certain extent, we have people who we would like, I mean, there's a number of reasons why we invite people back. Sometimes we feel we've done some work, but then we haven't perhaps done enough work with one person, so we would invite them back. Secondly, we would invite someone back if all the work is gone, and we're getting lots of requests for it. And then we would invite people back if their work has changed and we think that that's sort of interesting. So there are a whole variety of reasons why. We don't have a set formula, though, where we would say, like, we'd have two people back every year and six new people. We don't really do that. But it seems to fall into that. We do try to do one faculty artist, one local artist, meaning from the immediate locality or the region, and then we try to get the other five or six artists on a national level.
Do would you mind discussing the financial structure?
Not at all.
Yeah, with the artists, I mean.
With the artists, okay. Initially, as I said to you, when we invited the artists in, we pay them an honorarium and we covered all their expenses under the state guidelines. In other words, you know, that sort of set amount, $7.20 for breakfast and lunch and dinner, whatever. And we put them up in a hotel. And then we always try to collect them and bring them back to their hotel so that we don't have to hire a car. So we do that if we can. Sometimes they want to be a little more independent. And then we pay them an honorarium at $1,000 to $2,000, depending on how much money we're successful in raising. And in the beginning, we used to split the additions. And we would give them half the addition, and we would retain half the addition. And that was our half to sell, or that we would give to subscribers. And is everybody familiar with how the subscriber program works?
No.
Okay. So the subscriber program, when it was first initiated, was that people paid $10,000, and for that they got $20,000 worth of art, which was completely open-ended. In other words, they could get a 50% discount on a selection of prints, and they didn't need to select anything if they didn't want to. We actually have some subscribers who signed up in 1987 who have still not used their money. Those people, in my view, just wanted to help Bill Wiege and the press and just wanted to do something. Other people signed up, such as corporations, like the Rayovac Corporation, and renewed almost every year. So there were a variety of people. About 3 years ago, I changed that. And it's now, the subscription program went up to $12,000. And for that, you could get $20,000 worth of prints. But essentially, it translated into a 40% discount. Okay, now, because we were selling a lot of subscriptions, we now have 40 subscribers. We needed to be sure, because of this open-ended policy, which is one of the most interesting aspects of it, what makes it very a great incentive for people to buy, we needed to make sure that we always had enough prints to meet our subscribers. So I did an analysis of this, and we never sold, even with our most popular prints, we never sold more than a third of the edition to our subscribers, which would be, in actual fact, a sixth. It would be like a third of the 20. We used to do editions of 40, so we rarely sold more than 7 to subscribers of any edition that we did. So what I did was I recommended that everything be changed financially. We were not covering production costs. And if an artist went to a print workshop in another press, they were not paid until the production costs were covered. So I felt not only are we paying the artist an honorarium and paying their expenses to come here, but we're also giving them half the edition and letting them sell it wherever they want and essentially competing with us. Because the other thing that struck me at the time was I went to Cleveland on one occasion to show some prints at the Cleveland Museum, and they said, oh, we already have these in our collection. And what had happened was that the artist had sold the prints directly to them. So, you know, we had funded everything and, you know, we had covered all the costs. So, what we now do is, although there are some variations of an artist negotiates with us, so it's not in stone, but it's definitely a strong rule of thumb. We take a third of the edition to cover the production costs right off the top. And that meets the needs of our subscribers. So in other words, we've also done smaller editions on a general level because we think that people want to have, you can have a big inventory here of the same print, 40 of those prints. We don't want that. We want a big inventory of more than one print. So we made the edition smaller. We sometimes do 30, we often do 20, and so they're the sizes of the editions now. We rarely do 40 in the edition anymore. Then, so we take one third for production. Then we strongly encourage the artists to let us sell the entire edition. And so what we do in that instance is, with the remaining two thirds of the edition, we sell the edition for the artist, we handle all the finances, and we split 50-50 after any types of discounts. So for example, in the gallery structure, a gallery would be entitled to a 40% discount. So we take a print at $1,000. They get 40% off, $1,200. The artist gets $600. Tandem gets $600. Now, there's been a move lately, which just happened in the last year or so, where some of the top galleries have now switched to a 33 1/3%. And that's the next big issue that we're going to have to deal with. Whether the gallery gets 33, the artist gets 33, and Tandem would get 33. It's an extra 3% for us. I still feel that Tandem needs to be a little bit more competitive in terms of just marketing our prints and keeping our budget up there. And so I'm a little reluctant to change it at this stage, but it's something that we're considering at the moment. But that's how we do it. Now, sometimes an artist will say, no, you know, I don't want to sell my prints, you know, I want to keep some, I want to give them away, and so on and so forth. Well, then we just let the artist take a third, and we take two-thirds. So that's how we do it.
One of the early board members was Joe Wilfer, and he was on the board when I was for a while. And I know that he was very influential, very helpful in many ways to Tandem. Could you talk about Joe a little and his influence on the press?
Well, I mean, I don't know if we'd really be here without Joe Wilfer, actually, because I think that what he did was, before we were able to establish a national reputation, which I think we've managed to do at this stage, he talked about us as if we already had one. He was on the board almost, I mean, he was appointed to the board right after I started and stayed on until his death last year. He provided introductions to all the artists, many of the artists whom we had at the very beginning and in the succeeding years. He would tell us about artists who, if we wanted to get artists, he would, you know, advise us on, you know, whether it would be a good idea, because some artists, the level of which they work is so complicated, and projects might take a much longer time, and that it would be very hard for us to finish certain projects with certain types of artists where they would need a lot more time. He advised on that sort of intricate detail. He provided specific introductions and told people to come out here. And then one of the main things that he did was he really helped us financially, because he told Dick Solomon, that who is the director of Pace Prints, that, you know, the best way to get certain things done and the cheapest way to get them done would be to have them done at Tandem Press and to pay us to do it. Now, I don't know if that was true or not, but he sure told Dick that it was. And he negotiated major financial contracts for us in the very, the early years, which were enormously beneficial. The successful Robert Stackhouse project, Approaching Diviner, was funded, even though that was a print that we did. The companion piece and that piece was funded by Pace. The three Julian Schnabel prints that were extraordinarily successful for them was a contract specifically for Tandem for which we were funded. And then the major Chuck Close print, which was done here on handmade paper that did not work out, but was subsequently done as a silk screen because they kept all the templates. Was done here. And not only did that, all of those projects help us financially, but Joe would come out here as the director of publications at Pace and run the show, take over the shop. And it was an experience that any of the students anybody who experienced it, I mean, I will never forget it. I mean, I'll never forget it myself. I mean, he brought a high energy, can-do atmosphere, and he always spoke in such a loud voice, and nobody could be sleeping at the table, that was for sure. Everybody was hyped up doing things. And when he and Bill got together, I mean, it was unbelievable. Some of the things that, you know, occurred were a little wacky, but, I mean, it was great.
They worked.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that was really funny, in my view, that I'll never forget, was when the Chuck Close project was a project that they wanted to do at Tandem. And they ordered the paper from Japan, and ultimately the paper was made, and I think it must have been pressed down. It was a 6-foot by 5-foot sheet of paper, handmade paper. That was where they, it was pressed down, and there was a seam in the center of the paper, which Chuck Close hated. And of course, the more it went, it was a reductive linoleum block print, and the more it went through the press, the more that seam began to show. And Chuck Close arrived, and but before any of that happened, of course, the big question was rolling out the ink on the blocks to do this. So Bill said, came in to me and said, you know, we need to get a big roller to do this. I said, sure, no problem. And he said, and don't worry, Paul, you know, it won't be an exemption that you'll have to put through, you know, because there's always an exemption for everything that I'm always looking for. And he said, because, you know, Pace will pay for it. I said, great, okay. He said, so we'll get it manufactured, but we need to sort of, you know, if you could contact the people for us and everything. And I said, fine. He said, let's contact Mike Bunch, you know, the guy who built the press. I said, fine, no problem. He's, and he said, you know, I think we need something that weighs about 250 pounds. And I said, I try really hard not to overreact, you know, and I said, so, Bill, who's going to be able to lift it? No problem. So, you know, my part of my job here is to say, no problem, enable things to happen, but also be worried about, you know, workman's comp, the students who might get injured, if everybody has their insurance up to date, and so on and so forth. But it did work. And they did roll out the ink, and it was very even, and it's still sitting in the back. And maybe it will be used for another project someday.
You'll have to.
But it was, and we have great slides of it, and it's a great thing to show at a slide talk, to show this 250-pound roller, which there's a photograph of Bill and Joe Wilfer rolling out the ink. But it was, you know, I mean, you see a lot of really exciting things like that, which you think are, you know, there's no way people can do this, and they do it. And then you see the tenacity of the artists like Chuck Close, who, you know, is a complete paraplegic, and he's leaning over the linoleum block, and he's looking at the hands cutting, you know, and he's telling people, no, no, don't do it this way, you know. And I mean, people see things here that I think maybe change their lives.
And Wilfer would come out for all of the board meetings.
Yes.
Every 3 months.
He would.
From New York.
And he would have been very pleased this weekend that the Packers won.
He'd be in New Orleans.
I thought that he would have been in New Orleans. You're right, you're right, you're right. But this is a funny story, which has nothing to do with anything, but Sam Gilliam has just been awarded an honorary degree, and he's going to get one from the UW this May. The UW have awarded him an honorary degree. And the art department nominated him, and we got all the letters together and everything. But he phoned me the other day. He got the official letter to say that he had been given an honorary degree, and he was asked if he would like to come in May, and he was going to come in May. And he said, well, now I think there is a heaven, because I know that Joe Wilfer arranged this for me.
So possibly Eric Rudy?
I think it was fun. I think that he just felt that there was Joe feeling up there, get a tandem artist in there, you know.
Yeah.
I was cute.
Sure, he's got it well organized.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I was wondering, you have 40 subscriptions now,
mm-hmm.
but you started out with half that.
Right.
I wondered how subscription funds balanced against other sales funds in the beginning and now.
Well, for the first 2 years, the press ran completely on subscription funds. And now, I mean, this year, so far, we have sold 6 subscriptions. Last year, we sold 1. The year before, we sold 10. So that's a very, you know, that's one thing I haven't been able to track. Our goal is, every year, to try and sell 10. Try and get people to use up them and renew them. So try and sell 10. And then the rest of the funding we try to raise through sales and fundraising.
So I guess what I'm trying to get at is that you've been out a lot more to beating the bushes since you've gotten here, haven't you, than the previously been done before at print fairs and
Right. We do about, well, we definitely do, we do 2 to 3 print fairs every year. 3 to 4. We do Chicago, New York, the IFPDA, which is the International Fine Print Dealers Association Fair. And we've done that for the last 5 years, and we've done Chicago for the last 5 years. And then we've experimented with other fairs. We did Art Fair Seattle, and we did Art Fair Miami. But we then do a number of smaller fairs every second year. Last year we did the Cleveland Art Fair, Print Fair, and we've done the Milwaukee Print Fair, and this April we're doing the St. Louis Print Fair. So we always try to do 3 to 4 a year. But then the other thing we do now is, because some of our prints are so large, and the way a lot of people sell prints is that they will, you know, carry them around in a portfolio, but our prints are sort of big, and I'm not very tall, so if a print is bigger than you, which happens in my instance, doesn't, it's not, it looks even bigger, you know. If somebody had my jaw and they were 6'3" or something, it might be good, but I mean, when the print is bigger than you, I discovered that when I went in to sell a print and I rolled it out and it was taller than I was, and I was like, oh my God. So now what we do is we try to organize exhibitions in galleries and or in museums. And what we've done in museums is we say to organizations such as, we did one in the Birmingham Museum of Art, and we've done one in the Cleveland Center for Contemporary Art. We say to an organization such as this, you're a nonprofit, we're a nonprofit. Our mission is completely educational. Our mechanism is for raising our funds. However, we have something that we can sell, but our whole mission is educational. But we have to raise our money in this way. If you host us for a weekend, we will bring all our prints and we will show them and we will give you a percentage of the proceeds. Now what that does is that enables the museum to raise money kind of easily, and we share the expenses then. They send out the invitation, they host the reception, and then we bring all the prints and cover our transportation. And so that's how we've done a lot of additional sales. And what it does is that we don't know a lot of people in the area, and they do, and they can identify collectors, and that's been a very useful way of getting additional funding for the press without kind of going door to door. Door to door is quite hard for us because it's very time consuming. Even though, you know, when you do these art fairs, it's terribly expensive, but in terms of the number of people who see you and the number, the follow-up that we get. I mean, when we did Art Chicago last year, for example, we sold 51 prints right at the fair. And then the follow-up, we sold, I mean, we have continued to sell prints as a follow-up to that. So, I mean, even though the cost is probably close to $20,000, we more than covered our costs at the fair, and then we had a lot of follow-up business. People remember things, and things continue to happen as a result. And so it also sets a very professional tone for the press. People, you know, have this idea that we, you know, are a professional press, and they feel confident dealing with us and so on and so forth. So that's very important for us. Because we're so small, I think it's really important that we put out a very professional image.
I was wondering if you would talk about some of the artists that have been here. For example, an artist, the artist that you like the most, that was the most interesting to work with. Maybe the most difficult to work with.
Well, for me, I'm lucky, because I don't have any situation where, I mean, I'm not really working so closely with anyone that it can be difficult. Yeah. So for me, it's sort of very easy.
That's shop gossip.
Shop gossip, is that what you want? Yeah. Will I be quoted? Yes, I'm being taped.
No,
oh God. Yeah, right. Richard Nixon. okay. Well, I have, I would say that the good thing about the way I work and the bad thing about the way I work is that when a new person comes in, I find it really exciting and I kind of forget about the person who was there before. So it's really easy for me to, you know, when I totally get into what they're doing, then I'm so hyped up about it, I've forgotten the person who was there 2 months earlier. That's kind of bad. So, I mean, I'm continuously very excited by each successive print, I mean, artist who comes in and the way they work. I think that the artists who one might say are the most difficult are difficult because they're the most demanding. But I think that in that respect, they are probably the most exciting because they are generally complete perfectionists in what they want. And they want everything done again so they can see exactly how it might look without a glitch or whatever, which can probably be, you know, sort of frustrating. But on the other hand, from my perspective, for the students to see that, it's incredible. Because I think that an artist, a student who is an artist, who wants to become an artist, or is spending a lot of time alone on their artwork, they are going to be fairly isolated a lot of the time, and they are not like working in an environment where people are saying, you know, we have to have this done and we have to have that done. They kind of forget what it's like to have demands made on them because they're putting their own demands on themselves. When they encounter a highly professional artist who is 100% obsessed and focused on getting something right, I think it really inspires the students. I mean, I see that happening again and again and again, that the students are completely inspired by that obsessiveness and attention to detail and knowing exactly what they want and how they want it. So in that way, I think that's great. The most difficult artist, I think, was probably Chuck Close, even though he was not one of our artists. Because he was so he was so demanding and so frustrated, and I think that probably everybody was a little in awe of him, and I think that we all knew the project was not going well on the third day, and it lasted for another 10 days. Now, there was a product out of it, so therefore it was the right thing, but I often wondered whether it should have been stopped. But everybody was in awe of him, and nobody was able to say, maybe we should stop. Maybe we should all go home and come back and try this again. I thought it was absolutely incredible what happened, though. Here was somebody, you know, who was paraplegic because of the illness that he had had, and he had a dreadful cold when he was here, and he smoked cigarettes, and we had a reception for him, and he agreed to come to it because the whole community knew he was here and wanted to meet with him, and he was really sick that day, and he said, oh, don't worry, I will come. And I said, well, it's okay, but he knew that, of course, that I would be really disappointed, so he did come, and he started to cough. And he couldn't catch his breath. And I thought to myself, this is how Tandem will be remembered. This is how Tandem will be remembered. And so I just remember being running around, trying to find out if there was a doctor. And there was a doctor here. And he calmed him down. He was taken to the emergency room, and he was okay. But that was probably scary, and it was sort of frustrating. And it was... But it was memorable because he knows exactly what he wants. And if he isn't happy, there's no compromise. I mean, we compromise so much in our lives. And to be around somebody where there is no compromise was an amazing kind of thing to see. But I don't know if one would call that difficult. I think that was just like...
Memorable.
Yeah. See. So... one of the most fun artists we had was Judy Pfaff, who was also very demanding. She was here for, she came first, the Madison Print Club asked her to do a print for them. And I said to her that I gave her a great deal to try and get her. We had been trying to get her for years. So I offered to do it at a price that she couldn't refuse. So she went to Crown Point Press, and they said, no way, we can't do it. And so she came to us, and she spent 10 days working on one tiny print. And the deal was that she would do a print for us as well. And I knew that there wasn't going to be no print for us, so the next thing was cajoling her to come back. And of course, she's so busy. So she said she would, and so on and so forth. And I asked her at the very end why it had been so difficult for her to do this one small print. I mean, it was this size. It was beautiful, but it was a really small print. And she said to me, well, you know, it's a gift, isn't it? I mean, you do a print for a print club, it's like a gift. So it has to look like a gift. It has to be like a present. Can't be just like a, I mean, you know what I mean? You have to give a gift to someone, so it has to be different. And she, that was what she was thinking the entire time. And I thought that was an amazing kind of thing. But the way she worked was that she had her television going all day long. Her husband came with her. Her dog came with her. She played the stereo as well. And she worked from 8 in the morning until 1 or 2 the following morning. And that was incredible. And then when she came back, she worked for another 10 days. And she knew I was very worried. And so when I would walk into the studio, she'd go, "Ooh, here's Paula." So I had to try. So she worked on a whole variety of plates on that second visit, some of which she had started on the first visit. And only in the last, you know, couple of days did she begin piecing things together and deciding which things would be prints, which images would be prints. And on the very last moment, she made more changes. I mean, she had a whole series of individual small prints, and then she just said, I'd like to see those four on one sheet of paper, and those four on another sheet of paper, and these two on a sheet of paper, which had not been decided up to this, so everything had to be rerun afterwards. But I think that it was, she was one of the most perceptive artists that we had. She knows herself so well, and she loved talking to people, and she did student critiques for us, and the students were very impressed by her, and so that was very exciting. And I don't know, every artist has been so different. I mean, it's just been really incredible. That's one thing about working at Tandem. You know, you feel you learn something new every day, and you do, because you just encounter these incredible people.
Do you set up special arrangements for some artists that you must have gotten some that really need a kind of privacy to work? Working at a press means essentially you have an audience. I mean, there are a lot of people around, and some people thrive on that, but then there are others, I should think, that would need a little private space or...
Right. There have been two artists in particular. The first was Suzanne Caporel, who is incredibly shy. And she travels with her husband. I mean, he comes with her, and they go to lunch every day. And he takes, you know, he comes back to collect her in the evening. And she is so shy that she doesn't even like to give any talks. However, because when we give someone an honorarium, I mean, there has to be something affiliated with that. So I asked her if she would do critiques, and she did lots of critiques for us, and the students really loved it because she does not mind talking one-on-one. But in her instance, we closed the studio, which we rarely do. So we didn't allow people just to wander in. I mean, we have people who are like friends of Tandem who just like walk in the front door and down to the studio and just chat with who's ever there, which in most instances, people like Bob Cottingham, who work in their studio all the time, are delighted with. They don't mind. They're happy to talk with anybody. They say, you know, we're out, we're in a shop, this is great, you know, I don't mind. And they're not worried about that at all. But Suzanne was not, I mean, she's just a very, very shy person. And I think maybe she just needs to have a certain equilibrium and not get knocked off by, you know, sort of strange conversations. The other person that we closed the studio for was Art Spiegelman. And the reason we did that was because he was so well known that everybody wanted to meet with him. And he would not have gotten any work done, which is part of the problem. So we sneaked him in before anybody knew. And instead of giving our talk like at the end, of the first week, and then there's always a few extra days when the artist is here. We actually had him give us talk on the very last day when everything was done. And we had to make all sorts of arrangements for him so that he could get back to the studio and not be disturbed and so on and so forth. And we kept it top secret that he was here. No one was allowed to tell anyone that he was here. And so nobody knew he was here. And then when he gave his talk at the Avium, I discovered there's a door in room 160 that you can sneak people out of. I never knew that before. And
before the lights go up.
Before the lights go up, we did that. And anybody who wanted books to be signed, he's most agreeable. This is why it takes hours, because he signed anybody who wanted their book signed. He told me to make an announcement, and I collected everyone's book. And he did cartoons in all the books and autographed them for people and made them out. I mean, he spent ages doing it, but he just didn't want to get caught up because he wanted to finish the print. He was completely focused on doing the print. And so that was the other sort of person who wanted privacy for a different kind of reason, because he was just afraid he would be deluged. And he would have been. And afterwards, when he left, I mean, I got very irate phone calls about, you know, if I was his manager, and, you know, someone said to me, I have it on very good authority, he's coming back. And I said, well, he's not coming back here. And they said, well, who are you? And I said, well, I'm the director. Well, are you sure this is not the, I mean, it was very interesting. So I sort of, it was sort of an interesting kind of thing, but I was certainly kind of attacked on that one.
What's your usual schedule? I mean, they come, the artist comes and works on plates or whatever. How long are they here? A week?
A week to 2 weeks, depending on the artist. Well, what generally happens is that if the artist has been here, well, in all instances, Andy Rubin phones the artists in advance to find out what they want to do. And he really tries to get preparatory work done in advance. Actually, for everybody, that now happens. So even people like Sam Gilliam, who, you know, tend to work with a big group of people, we now make the paper in advance for him, and with very specific specifications, that's all done. So a lot of what people want to do is that's all talked about in advance, and work is prepared in advance of their coming. Generally, when we don't know an artist, it's for about a week. So we generally fly in on a Sunday night, come in first thing on Monday morning. They would generally give a lecture on a Thursday, and we have a dinner in their honor on a Thursday night. Friday and Saturday they finish up and fly out on Sunday.
They finish up, they've done their plate work and the initial proofing, and you try to work toward a BAT.
Correct.
Yeah. So then the edition is pulled later.
Right.
You have to match the BAT, or you send a few copies to them to have them check it over.
Very much so. In fact, this year we have no BATs yet, which is very unusual. Now, first of all, our printing schedule got way out of whack because we, Judy Pfaff, instead of doing one print for us, did 11. And Jean Quick-Tissé Smith, instead of doing one print for us, did 6. So we had a huge number of extra prints this year, even though we made small additions. 20 in the case of Judy Pfaff, and 12 and 20 in the case of Jean Quick-Tissé Smith. Generally, we try to get a BAT if we can, but we're dealing this fall with two very interesting artists. I mean, we dealt with Spiegelman, who has not, this was only the second print that he had made, and so he wants to see some artists who, such as yourself, who would say, look, this is fine, I just want that yellow a little lighter, this is the way I want it. And you've envisioned it because you've been a printmaker all your life. He wants to see the whole thing again. And he worked on a two-sided print, which was basically a Lead Pipe Sunday 2. It was a comic strip, and it depicts basically the end of the century and all the demise of the comic characters in the centerfold. And on the front page, it's a storyline about Darby Dugan, and on the back page there's an abstract. Now, there's one slight color he wants changed, but he wants the whole thing done front and back one more time. So it's like 2 days of production to get it exactly right. And this has gone on for quite some time, but that's okay. I mean, that's no problem. I mean, that's what the artist wants, and Andy has worked very closely with him, and that's fine. And the same with Hollis Stiegler. She was only here for a week, though. Actually, Art Spiegelman was here for 1 week, and then for a weekend, he flew back to make some corrections. And now it's, like, so close.
Well, you may have to bring them back.
Definitely.
Yeah.
If well, what we have done is, if we feel, Andy and myself talk about this. Now, with Art Spiegelman, we definitely wanted him to come back because it wasn't close enough. And you could do it through the mail. But, I mean, I think that doing things through the mail, it slows it down for years, really. It's much better to get the person back here. Also, with him, I mean, he knows exactly what he wants, but he is not a printmaker. So he's not used to making prints or making, you know, doing a BAT with these corrections, which perhaps someone like Bob Cottingham would sign off on. You know, I've seen him sign off BAT with corrections. So with someone like him, it's much better to get him back. So Andy and myself would talk about this, and we would just make a decision to say, you know, like on a Thursday or Friday, if we think it's too far and it's not going to happen through the mail, I mean, it might die. And that's what we don't want to happen. We want something, you know, to keep going. So at that point, we tried to book them back in immediately, a couple of months later.
Would you bring Bill into this kind of decision making? Is he working that closely?
No.
Yeah.
No.
It's you and Andy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, Bill, I mean, Bill would work when someone like Sam Gilliam is here, but, or he would come in, you know, if someone wants to try something and he has some way of doing something, but no, not on that sort of thing, no.
And Sam Gilliam, because they have a long history of working together.
Right, right, very much so. Yeah, no, Andy really would be making most of the decisions at this stage.
Do most people you invite come?
Ah, well, that's an interesting question. Most people, if we could, well, I mean, it's very hard to get blue chip artists here. So we've invited a lot of people who have not come. It seems to be getting a little easier for us, but I probably spend more time on that than any other part of my job.
Is it getting easier just because you're getting a better...
It is, but, you know, people are like... We tried to get James Rosenquist to come here.
Mm-hmm.
The Avium even had a show of his work. And I think I made 200 calls to him. And he would just, like... I would call him on a day like today, and he'd say to me, like, I was looking at the weather map. How do you live up there? Are you crazy? I would...
That's why I did all that stuff at USF.
He's from
Dakota. That's a
good
point. Not anymore.
So,
you know, he was one of the most cooperative visiting artists that we had in the old days when they would come for a month. And students loved him.
I know.
Yeah.
I'd love to get him back here.
And he was so helpful to many of the students later in New York. He had a studio in Soho. And the Wisconsin students were really very welcome to go and visit.
See, I think that is part of the problem for these artists in many respects. They are such generous people. I mean, the problem is that they're overextended. So they, you know, as they get older, they just have learned to say, I just can't do it. And that is our problem. I mean, we tried to get Wayne Thiebaud. I went to a corporation in town and said I was trying to get Wayne Thiebaud. And the director, the president of the company, said that they would make an award of $10,000 as an honorarium if I could just get him here. This person loved his work. And it would be an outright grant just to come, plus expenses. And so I've been calling and writing, you know, for about 2 years. And so I called him, and then I talked to his wife, and I said to him, you know, his wife, you know, I have this great opportunity to do something, and I'm wondering if I could talk to him. So she says, so he just like then phoned me back one day. I mean, it's like you try and you try and try, and then suddenly you pick up the phone. Hello, can I speak to Paula Finch? I go, yes, this is Paula. This is Wayne T. Well, you know, oh, you know, where's my notes? You know, no kind of nothing ready, you know. And so I said to him, well, you know, we have a donor in town who would like to give you $10,000 if you could come here to do one print. And he said, you know, money's just not important to me. You know, time is what I need right now, and I'd love to, but I just don't have the time. And so, you know, so in some respects, you know, the problem for us is that a lot of these people, you know, who are good, who we want to get, top quality artists, you know, they either are linked up with people like Crown Point Press or Gemini or Pace Editions in New York, and they live close by there. And they don't have, I mean, it's a mentality thing. It's like, oh, you know, I'm going to have to leave and go to Wisconsin, and I don't know it very well, and I don't know the people very well, and, oh, you know, I can do it up the road. I mean, that's the difficulty that we encounter. And I think one of the things we had with Joe was that Joe was always talking about us, that, you know, if you go out to Wisconsin, my God, you know, it's your, you know, and that was a big help for us. And I think it has become a little easier because we've had some tremendous artists here. But I don't know if that will ever ease up. That's the hardest part of my job. It's what I spend the most hours on, getting nowhere.
Have you tried to get William Wiley recently?
Bill talked with William Wiley, and he wasn't able to. He said, oh, sure, I'll come at some stage. And we wrote to him, and I think but so he wouldn't come either. But he would be a good person to try again, actually.
He does.
He would be a fun.
Can you talk about the evolution of the print since you've been here, in terms of who's doing what, and from a technical standpoint as well as an artistic standpoint?
Okay. I need to go to the restroom for a second,
okay.
If that's okay. Well, artistically, I think that we have retained the same philosophy right from the very beginning. Our aim is to invite an artist whom we want to have here, and really not to get involved then in telling them what to do. We really feel very strongly that we should make that choice at the outset. Do we like the work? And if we like the work, then invite them in. And then we don't really get involved in, you know, saying, oh, we don't like that image or we don't like the other image. So in that regard, that philosophy has sort of been there right from the very beginning. I personally feel that the quality of the printing has really gone way up. First of all, we have two printers. I think that both printers have, you know, themselves developed over the years. I think that they've gotten used to running Tandem as a training program with graduate students. Initially, they would have people kind of coming in like in the morning and then another person coming in the afternoon. Now they really try to have one person coming in every day so you don't have too many hands involved in the print. They also are very good now at ascertaining who's good at what sort of things and putting the best students on to, you know, the best students for the job onto the right job. I mean, they've all really learned and developed those skills. And so, I mean, certain students, for example, who they wouldn't feel are particularly good at etching or don't have enough experience, they won't include in those projects anymore. We now have enough projects going on that they can do other things in the studio. And so I think that has really helped increase the quality of the prints. And I think that Andy Rubin has very high quality control. I mean, I think that, you know, he will say to me, you know, if I say we should do an edition of 30 and we agree on that, and he'll say to me, you know, we can't really do more than 20 of this. I mean, we're pushing it, and there are really only 20 good prints in the edition. And he's, you know, very strict about that. And so we really try to maintain quality in that regard. So I think, I mean, I personally think that the standards have gone way up. And I think that people are able to do a variety of techniques within one print. I think that's one thing that makes us different from other studios. I think you and I talked about that, Warrington, when you were here, that that's something that we should be offering, you know, that we can do a variety of things. The one thing that we don't really do very much is silkscreen. We don't really have the facilities to do that, but we have really, continued to develop in the other areas. Our only limitation really are the facilities in terms of etching.
Are you using that rear area now for etching?
We are, but we've just heard that that's maybe demolished this year. So we're going to have to find somewhere else, finagle somewhere else.
Another space.
Yeah, it's a bit of a problem, but I've heard it's in the budget. Of course, the budget hasn't been approved yet, but they're thinking of knocking down the whole center of the building and having all those cars that are inside be actually outside, which our colleagues over here are very upset about, because for them it's a pain in the neck to have to clean off the cars.
Yes.
for all the state employees, so it's much easier to have them in an indoor garage. But
they would knock down, but they wouldn't add on. Replace it with maybe a state-of-the-art etching room. How's your ventilation in the back?
Not great, but Andy is very strict about using as many non-toxic chemicals as possible. We definitely do all the etching in that horrible back room, way in the back, where we vent the fumes out. And if, you know, we've had a lot of discussions this year with Bill and with his project assistant about having students working here and making sure that we do have a vent system where there's, you can turn it on and then it runs. It's not great, but we're sort of concerned that students sort of will use too much, what's the word I want to use?
Solvents.
And we're concerned with 10 students working there without the experience of our printers, that there will be too much solvent being used, and that would make it very hard for people to work here the next day, because our venting system isn't great. But we've talked a lot about that, and Bill is, you know, Bill doesn't want that either, and he's very concerned too. So we've sort of like laid down the law about that a little bit. So I think it'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's not great. I mean,
no.
If people use, you know, things, if there's a lot going on, it can build up, but then we try to run the fans all night long. I think everybody's very aware of it.
It's a big issue.
It is a big issue.
God knows, it's really thrown the art department for a loop.
Yep.
Into chaos. There really are ways to solve that in fairly inexpensive techniques, too.
Right.
I've seen some shops where they use plastic hoses, drop them down, and with point ventilation. That's
right.
Very good.
The problem is that the studio, you haven't seen it yet, but the studio is enclosed within a garage. So there is no, I mean, if you were to vent, where it vents out to the cars. There's no sort of fresh air around the studio. The studio is actually an enclosed area within the garage. We have the safety people over here on a couple of occasions to ask their advice. They told us it was probably more dangerous with all the fumes coming from the cars. So
the one thing they specialize in is closing down your coffee machine, so you're not drinking coffee next to it.
I know.
No sandwiches.
So, but I think Andy is very careful. We have been concerned. I mean, we were concerned about the etching in particular, and now we try to do that. I mean, it's all done at the back. I mean, it's cumbersome because it's away from, you know, they have to walk a distance to do the plates. But we have enough people, really, in terms of students who can sit with things and time things and so on and so forth.
Well, yeah, I had one last question, just a basic structure question about the general board and what its function is. I think you mentioned it's drawn from the community and some people from far away too. What do they decide, and what's their function on the board?
Well, primarily they are advisory. I would see them as probably a lot of other boards. They are the people who are, you know, our spokespeople in the community who can talk about us. And we've just actually expanded the advisory board this year and added 4 new members. So we now have 15. We inform them about everything. We inform them about our budget and all our upcoming plans. And then in the last 3 years, they have been instrumental in terms of enabling us to undertake strategic planning. So over the past 4 years, we've gone through 3 strategic plans. And the first plan was done with a representative from Ostermeyer, with our board. And in that instance, we added in extra people. We added in some of the clients who we work with in New York to come and participate. We were trying to analyze whether we were doing a good job and whether we were doing the right thing and how we were different from other people and what we should specialize in. Then we did a plan. The most complicated plan we did was then in the second one. And we have a member of our board of advisors who's actually the chairman of our board. His name is Scott Robertson. And he works for a major construction company called BE&K. And he, we were sort of in between deans at the School of Education. And there was an issue whether Tandem was educational or not. Some people were wondering if we were really an educational entity. And so we went through a second major strategic plan on that instance. And we analyzed everything. We analyzed what we do, and we analyzed our administration. We analyzed the printmaking. We analyzed where we sell. We analyzed the artists we bring in, what we should be doing. We went through absolutely everything. And then we came to a conclusion that, and we pulled all these statistics together, how many students had worked here, how many hours they had worked here, et cetera, et cetera. That was really extensive. That went on for about a year. And in that instance, you know, we worked out that basically half of what we do is actually educational in terms of our outreach activities and so on and so forth. And we had a whole series of suggestions about what we would do. Then the third plan was really a plan that really looked at the business side of what we do, and that was done by 3 people in the School of Business, 3 students, under the auspices of their professor. And one was from arts administration and the other 2 were purely from business. And they analyzed the way we our budget is structured and how many prints we're selling and how many prints we need to sell and what we should do in terms of sales and so on and so forth. So that was a very much kind of a business plan. So we've had 3 separate plans. And we've had the entire board has been involved or has received copies of all of these and has had input to all of them. So in my view, they're very much involved. They know everything that we're doing. Now, the other thing is that it seems to me that for Tandem to survive in the long run, we are going to have to become involved in fundraising in a major way, because we cannot be dependent on the vicissitudes of the market, because too much of what we do is educational. And so if, for example, if we have a student who is in a learning situation who makes a mistake, and everybody makes mistakes, and an addition is not as large as we thought it would be, and we've already put up a lot of money into the upfront costs, and suddenly we can't get them all back. Well, then, we want this to be an educational entity. We want it to be a laboratory where people, you know, who come from art history might learn how a gallery runs, people from business might learn how the art business runs, students who are artists who know how a print shop runs. I mean, we want everybody to benefit, and the faculty to be involved, and so on and so forth. it seems to me that it's always been a struggle for Tandem to raise the last third of our budget every year. That's always been a struggle. And the School of Education has been very generous in helping us. But, you know, in increased, as, you know, things change and more needs come up in the university, we have to, I think, build on setting up some sort of endowment that would, in my view, cover a third to a half of what we do. Because a third of a half of what we do is directly linked to our educational programming. Mm-hmm. I mean, our lectures, our outreach, you know, and I think some of the community events that we've done and makes me think that we can really build on it. I mean, we do a wine auction every year, and we raise $25,000 free and clear from that. And Warrington and Francis, of course, did the print for that last year. But we raised $25,000. I mean, it's a lot. I mean, most people don't raise that much money from an event.
We tried to take our proper quantity of champagne out of that.
Oh, good. I'm delighted.
You possibly lost on us.
Oh, that's all right. That was free. That was good champagne,
too.
That was free. So, I mean, we feel that we've added some people to our board of advisors who we hope will help us with that, but we feel that we really need to set up some endowments for Tandem, that it's really important. And we've already started one, of course, with the Joe Wilfer Fund, and we have almost $100,000 in that right now, and Dick Solomon from Pace Editions in New York is helping us raise the other $100,000, and hopefully next year we'll be able to launch the first visiting artist under the Joe Wilfer Visiting Artist Fund.
The question was, what will a visiting artist do?
Well, that artist will do pretty much what some of the other artists are already doing here, but it's just that we would really focus on what Joe had done and maybe have a reception and just as a memory and make it a special award every year.
Any other questions?
No. I can't think of anything.
End of interview.